listening to the Addictive Podcast, where we discuss functional as well as dysfunctional drug use and addiction. Listen to families, professionals, psychonauts, and users who live with legal and illegal drugs in their daily lives. I'm your host, Mark Burrows, and with me as always is Michael Crouch. Today's guest is someone who I think the world of, and in full disclosure, is a very good friend of mine. I wanted her to come on the show because she is someone who comes from a more traditional background in recovery and has progressed and evolved to now taking a more modern approach when talking about substance use and substance misuse. The reason that's important to me is because I followed a similar pathway, as did my co-host Michael Crouch. And this is something that's not really talked about. We hear stories of people going from addiction to recovery, but not much after that point. Today, with all the options available for how someone wants to recover, these stories are now being rewritten. And this has led to a non-punitive, non-judgmental, compassionate approach to looking at drug use and addiction. For these reasons, I would like to welcome our guest, Executive Director of Recovery ATX, Jenna Sheldon.
Talking about identity and how we identify ourselves, you know, and I feel like in recovery, it's important for me to continuously be on a journey to be authentic, you know, and that's what's important to my identity. So for me, like over the last year or so, like I feel like it gets old to say, I'm Michael, I'm a person in long-term recovery. And what that means to me is bam, bam, bam.
Yes.
But I feel like that when a person that's like struggling with addiction or exploring this lifestyle, they hear us all say the same thing. We sound like clones. Like, and I don't feel like that's attractive. I feel like, you know, I feel like you lose your identity. And I think that's a big struggle. You know, and I want to jump into this. I think, cause if you're an RCO and we kind of do this, we kind of work with the same type population, that social support can be one of the most effective tools for helping people get well from trauma or substance use disorder or all kind of different things. But what can happen is, depending on the type of group, you can lose your identity. So I'll give you an extreme example. Like, you know, if you're a Vietnam veteran and you have a lot of trauma and you come back and you join a biker gang, you know, and you, if you've watched Sons of Anarchy, like they're committed to that gang, that group, over their own family. So they kind of lose their identity. Or let's say another group that's complete, like another recovery group that's completely against medication assisted treatment. Now you believe in that, but to be a part of that group, you have to conform. Or a cult, you know. So how do we help people, you know, or what's your experience? I would just kind of like, you know, delve into that, you know, because my whole 7+ years in recovery have been trying to get away from where I kind of gave my identity away to get help.
Yeah. Well, I love language. I love talking about how we talk about things and the implications around and the connotations. And this isn't new with working in the recovery domain, right? And when I say recovery domain, I mean this intersection of advocacy, service delivery, being of service to the community from a citizen standpoint, right? So, and I mean that specifically as it's separate from the industry of treatment. I've always loved language. It's always been a God-saving thing for me when I was struggling with school. I can pull my grades up with that stuff. When I say I struggle with how to identify, it's because I did very much in 2012, and I was brand new to complete abstinence, and really kind of starting to recover from a whole litany of poor coping, like self-destructive coping mechanisms, of which alcohol was like the most primary presenting, but it was a whole bunch of things. I fell in love with the anonymous people and the recovery advocacy movement and the writings of William White as we worked to develop recovery-oriented system of care in my town in Texas. So I very much was like, our stories have power. And I adopted that formulation of, I'm a person in long-term recovery, and what that means for me is XYZ, and what that's allowed me to do is ABC. And I clung to that. But with really falling in love more with harm reduction over the past several years, and understanding that when I say I'm a person in long-term recovery, and this is was a totally unintentional or iatrogenic, if you will, output of sort of putting these elements together, right? Our narrative, our recovery stories. I don't think anybody meant to alienate anybody else. But as we talk about being in recovery and how it affects people who use drugs, and there's no like identity standard that unites these two groups as equal or having equity. And so I really started to struggle long about last year. I was at Mobilize Recovery and I saw Ryan's podcast with you guys last night. I watched it. And it occurred to me in that moment when we were talking about community planning, Michael King had posed the question of what things are you talking about or should you be talking about in your community? And I stood up and I asked the room, and again, this really was a very organic, endemic sort of unfolding in the moment. I said, how do we use this language about introducing ourselves to this recovery space without inadvertently placing ourselves over in a hierarchy over people who use drugs? Because we want to highlight what's been an overcoming, a championing over struggles in our own lives that could very well have been fatal for us, right? Where do we find the balance in highlighting those things, but also not marginalizing the people who choose to use drugs and who want to stay in that lifestyle and who have agency over their lives? And so that when I say it's a struggle to figure out how to introduce myself, it's because I'm still developmentally in my recovery journey, still trying to figure out who, what that means, how to say it. And then not only when we talk about harm reduction, people who still use drugs, but then also the whitewashing of the recovery domain, a very Anglo, Euro, normative, assumptive standpoint.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting how we cling. I mean, I guess humans in all areas do that, right? We all cling to this identity. We all want to be part of a group. And I think it probably even way back in like the AA days, you know, like this whole like, hi, I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. That was like a way to conform and have a group. But then you even within that identity, you saw people branch out, right? And you saw, I mean, I remember there was this guy around town that would say, hey, I'm so-and-so and I'm a darn old drunk, right? Now we know that that's like very stigmatizing language, but it was funny how like, he took the whole like I'm an alcoholic and branched it off to that. And you hear people in the rooms say different variations of I'm an alcoholic, right? And now what's cool about the whole I'm Mark and I'm a person in long-term recovery and what that means to me is blah blah blah, what's cool about that is I think it kind of opened up the door to like thinking about that stigmatizing language, thinking about how these labels can be damaging sometimes. And it kind of, it opened the door to like these new ideas, like the way you just introduced yourself. And I remember I spoke to a group on Thursday and I was kind of like proud of how, cause I always try to change it up. And so I said, I'm Mark, I'm a person in sustained remission from opioid use disorder. And what that means is, or something like, and that means that I haven't used illicit substances since, for almost 9 years or whatever. So I was like, yeah, that was good. That sounded, and it like rolled off the tongue really well, you know. But go ahead, Michael.
Well, I think the problem with all of this is like, I support your freedom to be a darn old drunk or a person in sustained remission or whatever you want to be as an individual. I think as professionals, it's important to kind of think about what we say. But what happens is, and like the people I've worked with, so like I've heard counselors say, well, I call them addicts because that's their language and it doesn't bother them, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like, well, that that argument doesn't make sense to begin with, because certain groups have certain language that a part of that group uses, but it's not okay for somebody outside that group to use. And even people within that group don't like that language. So I think, you know, I don't know. I just think it's important for people to decide who they want to be. And I feel like that a huge, huge portion of the helping profession doesn't give people that ability to figure out who they want to be. And that's the biggest barrier, because, you know, it's hard to conform. Conforming doesn't help a lot of people. I conformed to a group because I was desperate and didn't know where else to go. But I feel like if society would accept us, we wouldn't have to go conform to the anonymous group or the smart recovery group or the church or whatever. I feel like we go conform because we're rejected by the rest of society, just like the gang member goes and conforms to the group because they feel rejected by most of society. My argument is, why can't society accept us? Why do we have to go? Why do they refer us out to these groups? Because I feel like they don't want to deal with us themselves.
Well, I want to add one thing. I think the reason it's important, what I wanted to convey with how I introduced myself the other day was I want individuals to think how they want to identify themselves. Like, how do you want to identify yourself? What's important to you? You know, how do you want to describe it? And that's why I was very specific with saying opioid use disorder, because a lot of times we just jump into this large category. Well, what's the actual problem? And for me, that was the actual problem, you know? So I think it's just about, you know, I just like the idea of getting people to think about what their description of themselves would be.
Well, and I think it's a good point when you talk about the audience, right? And so, and there are some of us who have been fortunate to become clinicians in addition to being like peer service delivery individuals. And so when we have that little sort of layer of extra knowledge when we go into a room of clinicians, that we can speak that language and say, I'm in sustained remission from alcohol use disorder or alcohol dependence, and we can talk that. We have the tools to do that. Not everybody has those experiences or those tools. And so I think this speaks to Michael's point about the influence that professionals in the realm that's serving human service populations, that they have some influence for a theory of change, but they don't know it yet. And many of them haven't been taught that. So I know as an addiction professional, I wasn't taught really about harm reduction or medications for opioid use disorder in any of my academic pursuits or professional supervision. We kind of touched on MAT briefly, and that really was just related back to the fact that our managed withdrawal component of our treatment center was offering Subutex using the brand name. And so those of us who were interns were like, okay, we kind of understood it. So there has to be a lot more work done. And this is really my jam. This is what I love to do. Workforce development for people who are working in behavioral health. I need to find a new word for that too. For people who are working in delivery settings, catering to substance use and mental health, we need a lot more workforce development to empower those clinicians. Because when a counselor says, or a clinician says, I call them addicts because that's how they refer to themselves, they ignore the fact that many of us have been ascribed that role. And so through self-stigma and shame, we have latched on, we've developed an attachment to that identifier, because we've got lots of adversive childhood experiences that have primed us to accept such a denigrating term, and B, that's just what the culture has evolved as. And that's just not okay. There's some research around clinicians adopting language that reflects the person that they're working with is beneficial. But when you start to use some of that language that is stigmatizing, then you're just reinforcing that. And then you may not be developing a good therapeutic alliance. You may be just trauma bonding with the person you're talking to.
Yep. And they don't, I think, and that's a good point.
I like that.
If you're, and it's called the labeling theory, part of that. And there is a good point to be made too. Like if you're working with a person that's been sex trafficked and they identify the person as their boyfriend, well, you know, that person is, you know, their pimp or whatever, but you don't want to, you know, you have to be trauma informed in that aspect. I just think it's really important to try to just use the best language you can, because, you know, that people have been inscribed those labels. You know, I didn't know. So when I came into recovery, I was Michael, I'm an addict, and it didn't really bother me too much because everybody else was doing it, or I was Michael, I was clean, and it didn't really bother me too much because I was doing it. And this is how the language we talked about helped, until I went into public and was Michael, then addict. Then I felt that shame. So I think a lot of the people work with, they don't know that it bothers them, because maybe even a treatment center setting, they don't mind using those terms and being labeled. But nobody wants to go, nobody wants to go to school. Like, let's say nobody wants to go back to school and be marked the addict, you know? So yeah. That's when you feel that trauma. That's when you're like, oh my God, like what's going on here?
Well, check this out. For me, it's kind of funny. Because my experience in early recovery was mostly in Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I suffered from opioid addiction. I always said, I'm Mark, I'm an alcoholic. And people would say, like, you know, does that affect you? Does that bother you saying you're an alcoholic? And I would say, no, it doesn't matter to me. Like, you know, I can skip over the language. I can choose certain words and take certain things to heart. But it's funny because I wonder if my experience was primarily in Narcotics Anonymous and I had to say, I'm Mark, I'm an addict. I wonder if that would have like struck a different chord with me and I would have actually taken it to heart. Because saying I was an alcoholic, you know, it didn't really bother me because I wasn't an alcoholic, you know? I was just saying I was to conform with the group, you know?
Let's stop the recovery dialects, right? And so I'm not going to mention that without mentioning, you know, Ashford and Brown and Curtis and the work that they did on the recovery dialects. You identify in whatever way is appropriate for the set and setting that you're in. And so when I'm in a 12-step room, I still identify accordingly. But I refrain from using that language outside of that context anywhere, unless I'm having like a one-on-one conversation with a friend and we're talking about that setting. I really try to talk about, and this has been a big thing for me, the way I phrase it is, I'm a person who developed a problematic relationship with substances. I developed a problematic relationship because then you're taking the focus off of the person and you're putting it on that relationship development. And that is what addiction is. It's a mechanism and it's phenomenological and it's different for every single person as to how and why it manifests in their life. And so that's what we're talking about, is that relationship. And at Recovery ATX, that is some sort of messaging I've been putting out around our recovery community organization and what we want to be doing at our recovery community center. And that is something I've been working with our new staff as we've onboarded them and started to train them, is to really delve into how we talk about these things in the community. So I've given them so much language stuff to look at, because it's important. Like, yeah. When we say language doesn't matter, I disagree. Like, that every time I introduce myself to you by my given name, I'm acknowledging that language is important. I'm not saying like, hi, I'm 47-year-old, blonde, Anglo-Saxon, mother of two, college-educated, home-owning. Like, I don't give you a list of descriptors. I tell you my name because it's important. It's an identifier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great point.
And here's I want to go back to what you were talking about, that workforce development. Like, you know, I see the fact that addictions counselors don't have a lot of common sense training, but do, you know, harmful, like how many clinicians know that if you refer Jimmy, who you've just put on Suboxone, to the NA meeting up the street, and then Jimmy goes to that meeting and he goes in, he's so happy because he's been on heroin for 15 years. And finally, he's not spending his money anymore and he's doing well. And he goes into that NA meeting and he says, let me tell you about this great medication I'm on. Like, I don't think they understand what's about to happen in that setting. Like, and that's one of the big issues I have. Like, Jimmy's about to be traumatized, even because he's going to tell you what's helping him, and he's about to be attacked. And I've had counselors in high positions say, "What do you mean? They still do that in NA meetings? Like, they don't understand. It's like, it's like part of the culture. It's part of the."
And then they wonder why it didn't work, and they fault Jimmy for not being compliant, and you know, or whatever, you know.
Yes. Continue to pathologize the person that is presenting with the very symptoms that we have been trusted to treat and to respond to, but yet we continue to pathologize them for their failings when it's the systemic issue. And it is a workforce development issue. When I worked for Texas Health and Human Services Commission, I co-authored our state's grant for opioid response dollars, and I designed our recovery supports infrastructure to really focus on the workforce development. And so we have three things that we brought into Texas, which are just now rolling out three and a half years later. And that is, we do certified MAT advocate training for our professionals, paraprofessionals, patients, and some recovery coaches have taken that training. They didn't have to, but, and then we do medication assisted recovery supports for recovery coaches, where we train them and role play with them, working with patients who are on MAT, how to deal with patients who are being pressured to get off MAT, and just sort of equipping them with the tools to walk with somebody in that. And then the third one that's about to roll out is we do the MARS project with Walter Ginter, who some of y'all may know, in the opioid treatment provider settings. And it's a 3-day training intensive where you bring in staff, administrators, clinicians, patients, recovery coaches, and you do like this immersive culture building experience to create a recovery oriented system of advocacy within the clinics. And that was a really important linchpin. And then one of the other things we did was with Oxford Health, we gave them a whole bunch of new staff, but we said, your staff have to be trained as recovery coaches. They're not going to function in that way, but they're going to get the training, that multiple pathways training that recovery coaches get. And then they also have to get all of these trainings around medication assisted treatment. And we saw these outreach come in, and they were selected based on their flexibility to adopt these principles if they didn't already espouse them as principles personally, you know, the acceptance of MAT. And we saw a huge increase in Texas in the amount of MAT people that were moving into Oxford House environments. We see a big increase in the houses that say, yes, we take people on methadone and Suboxone. And it's because we're really talking about shifting the norms.
Man, that's awesome, first of all, that you guys are doing that and so organized with that. But man, we can so use that in South Carolina, because anytime I go around and give talks and there's recovery coaches present, and then we open up for a Q&A, it's always about, I always get questions about MAT, you know, anything about MAT. How do you know which medication they should be on? What's a proper dose? When should they taper? Blah, blah, blah. So that is obviously a big topic that recovery coaches struggle with. They get a little training, right, Michael? There's a little training in the peer support training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somewhat, yeah. Well, I just think it's ongoing training. I don't, like, me personally, like, I have 10% of what I know may have come from trainings. Like, I feel like you have to educate yourself. Like, you know, trainings are just flipping through slides mostly. And, you know, you can take that.
No, you do the wrong trainings, my friend.
You can train that. But I feel like you have to go find the education yourself. To be, for me, that's what it's been, to be productive. Yeah, you're probably right. Like, we don't, and where we're at, I've been to some good trainings, and I did go to a good MAT training not too long ago, but I still feel like the education to learn comes from self-education more than a training.
It's experiential, and with adult learning, and many trainers think that you can just slap some cute PowerPoints together with funny memes to be relatable. But training involves a lot around adult learning theory. Andragogy is what it's called. And adults have to be intrinsically motivated to learn. So this principle that should be inherent in any training that you do, hopefully, is the same principle you're speaking to when you say it's about getting out and pursuing the education yourself. So for you, the other 90% has been wanting to know. That's intrinsically motivated, right? You want to know and you want to practice it yourself. And I don't disagree with you. I'm just giving you crap about being at the wrong trainings, but a really good training involves a lot of interaction, and people come away from those small group interactions like, I wish we could have had another half hour to do this together. Now I can't wait to go implement this in my organization or in my field. So, I mean, there's what you're saying speaks to a lack of really good training aptitudes available, but you know, a good training will create that bridge of excitement for you to be able to take that out into and be able to share what you're talking about, your competencies and your aptitudes with other people in a way that then you're transferring the knowledge and you're transferring the motivation and the passion. And so when we want to go learn about these things and get educated about these things on our own, that's great. But sometimes it's very helpful if you have a training paradigm that gives you a greater organization of your own thoughts and language to be able to present that to somebody else.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is just because, so my first experience with a peer recovery training was like, we talked about multiple pathways, MAT, you know, all this other stuff. But that opened me up to, you know, I didn't know about any of that other stuff. You know, I didn't know about other pathways. I didn't understand MI and all that stuff. So it was really like an eye opening. And I feel like a portion, I don't even want to put a percentage on that, have been so brainwashed to their own. They, most people just can't, like in peer recovery coaching, it's the biggest challenge is just to get people to let go of what they believe to learn. Like when you believe that AA is the best, then it's hard. You know, if you're not willing to let go of that, you're not willing to let go of that. And there's also to the trainer. So the last training on medication assisted treatment I went to was actually like, I did learn about like the difference between a person that may need methadone to Suboxone to whatever. And it was good information, but the trainer also made statements like very few people can stop using without going to treatment.
No.
And he also talked about like, you know, most, you know, he didn't understand the concept of natural recovery. And he also talked about like people, very few people can learn how to moderate their substance use. So like he was pushing abstinence and treatment. So I like, along with his good information on the medication.
There's so much misinformation out there. And I think that's part of the problem, right? It's like, if you come from a certain circle or a certain demographic, or you have certain friends, you know, you might be able to find a lot of this information on your own. But if you're not in those inner circles and you say, man, I want to learn more about MAT or whatever, and you go to do a Google search.
Yes.
Well, 95% of the stuff you're going to find, and I've actually written a blog on this, but it's going to be crap. It's going to be misinformation. You know, there's so much untruth out there on MAT, especially, you know. So it's hard. It's hard, I think, to find good information sometimes, you know.
It absolutely is. That's why it's important to have some of these, you know, like the Opioid Response Network and entities that can help standardize like evidence-based information that is non-stigmatizing and delivered in a way that is relatable for the workforce. In Texas, our recovery coach training curriculum, it's a 46-hour curriculum. I helped revise that for the 2015 revision of it. We work on, there's a particular exercise around recovery identities where you have people list what they consider their identities. And the virtual adaptation of that really lately, because we've just had to sort of revamp everything for online delivery. And our trainer at Recovery ATX, I'm a shout out to Brian Lane at Recovery Spectrum. He's the most phenomenal trainer I've ever worked with. He has classmates go through and just randomly X out two of the recovery identities that somebody else has chosen. And then they process on what that's like for somebody to strip you of your self chosen narrative. Many people come back who have taken that curriculum and say, there's some thought provoking small group exercises that make you really examine the way you do that to other people in the workforce when you just put them in a box and call them this or that. And so it does speak to this opportunity to have these very standardized structured forums where we get to create safe trauma-informed spaces to explore these things together and not, you know, you have to be a skilled facilitator to not like let some sort of 12-step abstinence-based argument get out of control in your training environment, because that's not safe for people. And so that's why I'm all about workforce development, because it's, it does set standards in a safe way, but not everybody is doing that.
Yeah.
It's speaking of like the idea of abstinence, I would like y'all's opinion on this too. So like, there's multiple facets to this, but like, so I didn't really have a big issue with alcohol. Like towards the end, I was on benzos and I used to drink because they kind of stopped working and I needed to kick them in or whatever. But like, I don't think if I was to go take communion at church and take a sip of wine, I don't think that's going to make me return to use. Like, I don't really want to be intoxicated, like, other, you know, like outside of maybe a little too much caffeine. But I don't think, and I think that's the biggest issue, is it's like all or nothing. I also know people that have used cannabis after coming off opiates the first couple years, and long-term recovery, they do drink sometimes, not very much, like, but it's not an issue. And I think we box people in that sobriety is only with complete abstinence or taking your medication as prescribed. Like, and I think that's how it turns into a club, you know? I seen and there's two more things and then y'all can jump in. Like, I listened to a podcast the other day and it talked about how if we used MDMA for like couples counseling, you know, and depression and stuff, how effective it was. And even in the 50s, they talked about like the results for psychedelics for alcohol use disorder was much better than what Vivitrol is today. Like, but this conversation would be like heresy in most of our field.
Yeah.
Heresy, I love it. That's so true. I mean, go ahead.
No, you first.
Okay, well, I mean, so with regard to, we've used abstinence as a litmus test for way too long. There's so many different types of abstinence. To the addiction area, the recovery research to do, when I tell people to go look up the different types of abstinence, because there's complete abstinence, continuous abstinence, mandated abstinence. There's a lot of different ways we can define abstinence. I feel like if we have acculturated people or assimilated people, ascribing them this false dichotomy of all or nothing, like you, if I wanted to do communion, I would not freak out over sipping wine. I don't feel like I'm going to run back out and dive into a bottle of Tito's. But I understand where for some people, they are very concrete, and that is the way they conceptualize it. Part of that has been a culture process, indoctrination, if you will. And there's a huge, this is a whole other conversation for a whole other time, but there's been a huge deviation in the culture around big book literature as it applies to the actual literature. It's a lot of dogma. But I don't think we do enough work publicly around messaging that it doesn't have to be this false dichotomy. It is different for each person. And I think that people are scared to. I think people are worried about like liability. What if they encourage somebody to just expand those horizons and maybe this person doesn't have the capability for moderating, you know? So it's still such fresh water to have to navigate.
For sure. No, those are a lot of good points. I mean, I think we're superstitious beings, you know, like we are all superstitious, whether you want to believe it or not. And even probably some of us sitting here now, like it's one thing to say that, like, we know that abstinence isn't necessarily, required or needed for long-term recovery, but like, are you gonna go test the waters, you know? And right, it's this fear of like, well, you know, you're like kind of like tiptoeing into this new idea, but like, are you gonna go test it for yourself? Like, I don't know, you know, it's scary. You know, we've been told for so long that this is how it's going to be. And if you do this thing, this is what's going to happen to you. And it was funny because I was hanging out with a friend the other day who maintains total abstinence, and yet he'll like bum cigarettes from me once in a while. And I was thinking about it the other night. I was like, that's interesting because he can manage his cigarette smoking. Like, he only smokes when he's with me. He never buys a pack. And that could be once a week. That could be once every 6 months. And yet we know nicotine is maybe the most addictive habitual substance known to man. Yet he's clearly displaying that he's able to control and manage his nicotine use, right? But he is staying abstinent from other substances, thinking that he can't manage it. So it's, you know, kind of interesting. You can make a good argument because he's clearly managing his addiction or whatever you want to say, you know? So I think we're just, and Michael's right about the caffeine intake. And I think we've overblown this whole abstinence thing because of superstition, because of liability, like you said, because what happens if you tell someone to go try that out and then, you know, it doesn't work out? I'll just disclose this. We went out, I went out with some coworkers a couple weeks ago. And did you know there's a holiday for National Pina Colada Day? So
I feel like I knew that.
So there's a National Pina Colada Day. And I ordered a pina colada because I was like, I love pina coladas, virgin or whatever. I love like fruity, like girly drinks like that. So I ordered this pina colada and I drank like half of it. And it made me really tired, like right away. And that was it. I didn't want any more. And I don't know, haven't thought about it since really. So, you know, now to each their own, and you've all got to figure that out. I'm not craving pina coladas every day since then. But, you know, it's very individual, I guess.
One thing I've learned, and this is what I feel like, I don't want to put a percentage, let's just say a bunch of people don't understand their own risk factors or what led to using. So I have ADHD, and I'm not going to dig down to what caused that because there's underlying factors for that too, but I've developed ADHD, and substances, particularly like prescription medication, like opioids and benzos, they would completely quiet that white noise in my head that made me think I had to do something all the time. It would calm me. And it would medicate, you know, it helped me, you know, it soothed me tremendously, you know. So I understand if I start taking medication again, or if I start using any substance to medicate those issues within me that are associated with ADHD, then I'm more high risk to develop addiction, not because I'm an addict or I have a disease or I have addictive personality, but no, because I have certain things associated with ADHD and social anxiety and trauma that make me, when I use substances, it fixes it. Now, and that's what we don't teach people. So I know that it's not good for me to do certain things. And but that doesn't mean if I have surgery and I need to take some pain medication for a few, that doesn't mean I'm going to return to active addiction.
Right, right. I have a therapist friend here in town, Lisa Medina, does a lot of harm reduction therapy. She trained with Andrew Tatarsky, and she tells people, like, until you resolve that trauma, it will be difficult. It may be, if you developed a problematic relationship with substances, until you resolve the trauma, it will be difficult to moderate in a healthy way your substance use. And I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. But I love that she says that. And so many people don't realize that. I know, like, I don't want to test the waters around alcohol, mostly because I've gotten to a place in my life where, like, I'm good. Like, I don't, it wouldn't fulfill anything for me. But I can also tell you that when I'm not taking care of myself and coping well, I'll transfer or translate those coping mechanisms to, like, processed complex carbohydrate foods. Similarly, made of a sugar structure like alcohol, right? So I see some themes there. And so the reason why I would continue to abstain from alcohol is if I can't control myself around a bag of popcorn or a can of Pringles, I probably am not going to tempt the fates with, you know, like a cranberry and vodka, or even a beer, because I just know that, like, I'm not in a place of self-regulation right now. Can I do that in the future? Maybe, I don't know. But today, I've got, like, I'm putting my energy and money towards other things, but I don't judge those people who do. And I have a friend who's been, in and out of the program, mostly in, for, I would say 40 years now. And she came up in AA because there was no NA at the time, really, in our little town. She eventually moved over to NA. Stimulants were definitely her, problematic relationship with substances. But because she came up in AA, she feels very conflicted about disclosing to people that occasionally she can have a glass of wine, because A, it's a small town and everybody knows everybody. She's also a clinician now, an LCSW.
Yeah.
And she did some training with, like, Jean Kilpatrick. I don't know if y'all know who she is, but she did a lot of work around the Women for Sobriety mutual aid group. Jean Kilpatrick was sort of the pioneer of that. And it's a little different from AA. Anyway, my friend has struggled with internalizing that stigma between AA and NA. Even though she can have wine, she would never, like, I'm one of the few people she would disclose that to because of this false dichotomy of abstinence that has been pushed forward. And it's really, when you think about it, it serves the 12-step facilitation modality of treatment, which is what most treatment centers, when I say intensive residential treatment, so 28 days or more, right? Many of them rely on 12-step facilitation therapy. It's an evidence-based practice anyway. So the abstinence narrative is very important for that business model.
Yeah, and this is where I get confused though. Okay, like, and I argue with people all the time. They say, we're doing the 12-step, clinical 12 steps, whatever you want to call it. Like, that's what I'm like, well, let me think about that. Do you think that if you had 12 steps and you just brought in Smart Recovery and said, we have these two things, you might increase choice, and more people would buy into recovery. But it's like, oh no, my God. Like, they think, you know, the argument, it's so crazy to me that, you know, just give them two choices. Oh, maybe you can give them three choices. Wow. Can you imagine offer a person two separate choices on a healthcare issue? Like, can you imagine going to the doctor and they say, Mark, we're going to say this prayer and this is what we're going to do and offer nothing else. Like, that's insane.
It's so ingrained. It's so ingrained. And I'm not, Jenna probably is more versed on this. I'm not read up on William White's, you know, papers and books and stuff, but like the history of addiction treatment in this country, it's so ingrained. It's so tied in with, there you go. Yeah. Slaying the dragon. Nice. It's so tied down with 12 step. That's where it comes from, you know, in the history of substance abuse professionals and treatment centers and sober living and all that. It comes from 12 step community, you know? So I think it's really hard for people to think like, well, how do you do it without that? You know, like that's what it is. That's our foundation.
Go ahead. I always talk, like, when at my job, I try to take the principles or the concepts within the 12 steps or really anything and try to make it more inclusive. So maybe you need a mentor, maybe you don't, but instead of just saying, go get a sponsor, I'm going to talk about how somebody can help you with guidance. Does it matter where that comes from? No, I work with people all the time that they get that guidance from a pastor that's in recovery, even though they wouldn't call it recovery. Or instead of saying you need to join a home group and do service work, we just talk about volunteer work, you know. And, you know, instead of talking about building a network of people in recovery, we talk about building a network of people that can support you. And maybe that involves people in recovery, maybe it doesn't. And I think, you know, that's the issue. Like, there's no there's no evidence that shows that 12 steps, the NAAA works better than any other pathway. ASAM actually says that 12-step groups have a 10% success rate, which is awesome. That's a lot of people. But that's no more effective than Smart Recovery or Refuge Recovery or any of these other groups. And truthfully is, like, the statistics show that there's 46% of people that have found remission did it without groups, treatment, or any of that stuff.
Yeah. When you put those statistics together in a comprehensive framework and you put it on a stand, like a bell curve, and that, like, it fits into the standard deviations for a bell curve.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense. So you've got like 5 to 10% on an outlier, you know, standard deviation. I think that I love your idea about, I've always wanted to like start a treatment center where it's more like school. You get to go, you kind of pick your, like, your theme, your, you know, what you want to study or whatever, and you have a menu of different support groups that you get to try instead of being loaded up into a van and taken to AA one night and NA another night. You have Smart Group, you have Dharma. I want to make sure I called it the right thing. You have Refuge. Sorry, that's different now. You have obviously your 12-step groups. You could have White Bison, Wellbriety, and just have a variety of different groups that people in treatment can attend. And instead of doing a treatment plan, you do a recovery plan. And as the person elects treatment, then that treatment plan becomes a subset of the recovery plan. And that, it really is everything that you were talking about, Michael, that is all within the realm of recovery management as a paradigm. That things are natural, that we do what fits best for the person in their own natural community. So if that's church and faith-based, then that's what it is, as opposed to saying, like, you don't go to enough meetings and you need to call a sponsor. That is so demeaning when somebody says, you better call your sponsor. What am I, too? I mean, really, like, you're stripping somebody's agency away. And so everything you describe, I want to do. Let's do that. I propose we do that. Let's make that a thing.
Can we do that? Yeah, and there's the concept of too, and fixed and growth mindset. So, like, you know, you can go to you can form a belief system and go back to college and get your degree and buy a house and do all these wonderful things. But if you have the mindset that I'm never going to be okay, I'm always an addict, you know, that the disease is, you know, I think that I know a lot of people that think they can't get to a place where they're okay. Like, there's always that ceiling because I'm always one step away from using. I talked about this in an all recovery meeting the other day. Like, I used to go to NA conventions and there would be all this, what they would call clean time. And we'd have these celebrations and there would be so much evidence of recovery working in people's lives, you know, but then we would hear about one person overdosing and you would think, like, everybody would go into chaos. Oh my God, we're not carrying the message. I'm going to use our home group. I'm not doing it. Like, one overdose would put a whole community into chaos, even though there's so much evidence that everybody else is recovering.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of good things about 12 step, you know? And I believe that the spiritual principles. And so I very much have the luxury of being able to go into a meeting and take what I need and trash what I feel is not working for me, because there's a lot of sickness perpetuated in some of the meetings. So there's a lot of wonderful things that come out of 12 step. That is a program that I still support and utilize regularly, but there are equally, it's no better than any of its members, right? Because each one is autonomous. And I'll tell you that the little town that I got sober in, which is a well-known treatment town in Texas, I have seen people, at least two people with like 30 plus years of time, get arrested for sex with minors, child pornography, like federal offenses. And so it really begs the question of this qualifier of time. And again, abstinence as a litmus test for some moral condition and capability and nimbleness for really truly being able to accept reality as it's, you know, sold out to us. And it's not just about that. When you look at time, it becomes such a delicate thread that this whole huge conceptualization of well-being gets balanced over.
Yeah, and I hate that. Like, I like the program and the structure of the 12-step program I used to go to. Like, you know, there's a lot more good. If I had to point out the only things I don't like, it would only be, like, in the steps. I don't like the character defects part, but yeah, the rest of it I think is great. Like, yeah, you know, and I don't like calling myself an addict, but I do like the concept of powerlessness over certain things.
Yeah.
You know, I just, again, I just feel like it's, my only issue is that it's biased towards that. Like, you know, there's too much bias towards it.
There's a lot of bias.
Yeah.
And but, also bias towards white men too, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. For sure. Yeah. It's dominated in a rural area. Like, you know, I remember my NA home group I went to, like, I remember my sponsor was a black dude, and he talked, you know, one day I put something on Facebook about, like, I don't even remember what it was, but it was like, not Black Lives Matter, but it was like advocating for racial justice, you know, and he showed up at the group, and like all the other white guys were talking negatively about the post that I did earlier that day. And then they kind of got quiet once he walked in. So, like, you know, the group wasn't the most, like, inclusive play, you know, for beliefs and ideas like the program is supposed to be, but it's very, like, rural 12 steps can be very, like, white male dominated. Yep. You know, and if you say that, you know, nope, that then they would throw the program at you and say, nope, we don't look at those things.
That's an outside issue. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's not an outside issue. Part of who you are is your recovery, you know, and how you identify and where you fit in the world. And being like a female, I can't tell you how many times I've had an uninvited hand on the small of my back as we're exiting a meeting from a man that I am have no desire, much less given consent to put his hand on me. And it happens all the time. So there are a lot of weaknesses.
I can't imagine being a female in the room.
And I asked you about that because, not to dig in too deep, but like, so, and like, I don't, not AA, I think kind of the ones I've been to, they hold hands, but a lot of the NA group, you know, you do get in a circle and like who you get beside, like, they're going to put their hand on you.
Yes.
And if you, people are going to hug you, like, how is that as a female, and how do you think it affects, like, females that's been through trauma? Like, yeah, you know, some groups you walk in, there's a hugger at the door and they're going to hug everybody that walks through the door. Or in that circle, you know, what are you going to do where their hand goes on your back, or maybe it goes down a little lower? I mean, yeah. I don't.
Sometimes that go into being a female in a 12-step related group. And it's often like going to the bar where you will have like a squad, a buffer zone, right? Watch my drink. That's harm reduction when I go to the bathroom in the bar. So same thing at AA, you will probably find yourself with some trusted individuals that you can say, like, I don't, so-and-so gives me the heebie-jeebies, and so can y'all circle up around me? You make these agreements with individuals, and it doesn't even have to be other females. It might be a trusted elder, you know, father type figure that you can be honest with and say, here comes so-and-so and I don't want to end up next to him when we circle up. There have been times where I have excused myself and I've gone to the bathroom during that whole part too, so that I can just protect myself and not have to be zeroed in on, because it's been my experience, and this is just my experience, it's never just one or two dudes. It is a plethora of them. And so, yes, being a woman navigating those situations, especially if you're seen as like eligible, can be very, very difficult. And for that reason, gender, I think, really is important as we talk about recovery and trauma informed, and we give women presenting individuals some extra coaching and tips and support for moving into these mutual aid support groups. It doesn't have to just be AA. It can be any old group, really.
Yeah. And then I've seen it go the opposite end of that spectrum to where it's extreme. And like, you see a woman come in and like shame the female for, you're not supposed to hug him. Like, you know, you're supposed to stick with us. And then it becomes controlling, you know, and then it's vice versa. Mm-hmm. Like, Mark, have you ever been hit on by a woman when you were early in AA?
God, I don't know.
I can remember walking into and I was so new and so like nervous, and I can remember a woman, like I'm talking about like less than 30 days, and the woman's like, "Oh, you're so sexy," and I was like, you know, everybody laughed like it was funny, like, but I mean, it's hard. But my point is, like, these groups are non-professional and they're helpful, but this is what people build their programs around, these things. Like, yep. An IOP program is built around these local groups where this stuff is happening. Like, drug courts build their program around these things. Like, courts mandate you attend these groups. Like, and that's what's insane. Like, a lot of young females, I've seen people come to groups, like, in rural areas. It's all men. You're going to show up, you're going to be the only female there. You know, there's not going to be any protection or that kind of stuff. You know, or you're the only African American to come in, and you walk in, and then people are talking about, like, they have like Confederate flag shirts on and stuff, like, and there's no workplace development that teaches that stuff.
Right. Or resources to navigate around. When I lived in Abilene and I was a counselor for teens, we had noticed that these teens were getting referred to AA and NA by juvenile probation. And many professionals, social workers who weren't even people in recovery, but who worked with these teens, were like, they need a safe place to go. And so they started what was called the teen recovery group. And that then later got funded with some prevention coalition dollars from the state. And it still is an existence now, because parents will be like, I'm not, you know, sending my 16-year-old daughter to the 8 p.m. AA group. And even parents in recovery are reluctant to bring their teenagers. So it's all about having a space that is safe and is fitting. And really, quite honestly, these IOPs, these treatment centers, they could do a better job. They could be stewards of creating these alternative spaces, because they have so much pool in their area. Because treatment has co-opted, and that's a whole other conversation also, the way treatment has co-opted the rooms of recovery. But they have the ability to do it. It's just whether they're doing it or not is the question. They could start a smart recovery group. They could start a Dharma group. They could start a teen recovery group. They could start a women for sobriety group.
Yep. And I had this argument the other day. I've had this argument with a guy that runs a recovery house and another guy that I'm friends with that is a director of an drug and alcohol treatment facility. And they both tell me that they can't do smart recovery because there's no smart recovery groups to refer people to. Like, they can't wrap their mind around the concept of them just doing it. Like, like that it doesn't take a bachelor's degree to learn how to facilitate a smart recovery group, you know? And that's what people, you know, it's so frustrating to me. And to be honest, like, for my own self-care, I can't fight every battle with every person. Like, I can't be the lone person fighting for smart recovery to be offered just as an alternative.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or please don't send these people to the NA group where I know that they're going to be shamed if they find out they're on Suboxone. It's hard. It's really hard. Like, I feel it's, and that's the frustration for me, is like, I need some help, but just give me two other people to join in. Like, you know, my own self-care can't take the lone advocacy work. Not anymore.
To learn more about Jenna's work, please visit recoveryatx.org. If you would like to support this podcast and the work that we do in upstate South Carolina, like syringe service, naloxone distribution, HIV and hep C testing, medication-assisted treatment with drugs like Suboxone, buprenorphine, and Vivitrol, along with advocating for the fair treatment of people who use drugs, please visit challengesinc.org.